I've told you before, is traditionally regarded as the breakup of the unity, medieval unity, of Christian Europe and the rise of the new monarchies. But this is a gross oversimplification. For as you know, none of the reformers wanted to destroy the unity of Christendom. In their own way, they all wanted to fulfill it. Moreover, in the first half of the 16th century, three big empires dominated the affairs of the known world. The Habsburg Empire in Central Europe, the Turkish Empire pushing into Europe, and the Muscovite Empire, which was to be the nucleus of modern Russia. All these three empires, the Habsburg, the Turkish, and the Muscovite, had universalist claims. All had claims which transcended mere continental Europe. And all were a reality, and all claimed world domination. It is the empire of Charles V, the empire of the Habsburgs, which came nearest to fulfilling this universalism, both, as you know, in the old world and in the new. As one of his Spanish servants wrote to Charles V in 1524, "If you can conquer the coast of the Pacific Ocean, there will be nothing more left to do for your excellency in order to become the ruler of the world." This was exaggerated, but the Habsburg Empire dominated Western and Central European politics throughout the first half of the 16th century. What then was Charles V's concept of his office? How did he think of himself? And here we must get rid of centuries of Protestant propaganda, which like to transpose at the Council of Worms, Luther and Charles V, the stubborn emperor and the reformer. That vision, that bit of Protestant propaganda is totally false. Charles thought of himself to be the shepherd of his people. Now, analogies are very important. The new monarchs, whom I talked about last time, thought themselves to be fathers of their people. Now, you may say it doesn't matter much whether you think yourself of the shepherd as of the father, but it does matter a great deal, because a shepherd protects his sheep, and a father in those days rules his family. A father can take his son's possession, anything he wants. But a shepherd, which is a medieval image, a shepherd rules and protects. That is the important thing. And Charles believed that as a shepherd, a medieval analogy, not like a father, a modern analogy, he believed like a shepherd, he was the protector of his many diverse people. The House of Habsburg was given its mission by God to protect the miscellaneous peoples which had come under its rule. Charles was not national, as I told you last time. Hardly anybody was. He was a foreigner even in Spain. He thought of himself in medieval terms as a kind of new Charlemagne, Charles the Great, but not at all in what we would call modern terms. He was the lord of his subjects. He had a higher responsibility for their well-being. The key figure in Charles's thinking is God. Everywhere he felt the power of God over him, deeply devout, above politics. His advice to his son, the later Philip II, is very typical. In the uncertainty of human events, I can give you no general rules, except to trust in the Almighty. You will earn this trust in the defense of his holy faith. contrast that with Machiavelli. Machiavelli saying that necessity must conquer Dame Fortune. And you have the contrast between, in a sense, the new, emerging new, and the old. God and family dominated Charles's thought. In his advice to his son, he goes on to say, the best thing is to consolidate the diverse countries. But notice, not yet through institutions, not through common institutions, but dynastically. The best thing is to consolidate the diverse countries through family alliances. Thus you must marry and have many children. A pure expression of the kind of dynasticism which I talked about last time, and which has yet dominated that stage in the growth of the national state. But together with this image of the shepherd, another ideal dominated Charles's concept of empire. The emperor was the moral ruler of Christendom, and he thought of this again in medieval ways. He was to lead Christendom against the enemies of Christ, the Turks, Muslims, the Lutheran heretics, the crusading ideal, so Spanish in a way. You saw it still alive with Ignatius of Loyola. The crusading idea is here. Charles's spokesman in Spain in 1520 interpreted the emperor's mission as the defense of Christendom against the infidel. Thus, Charles held faith fast to the Catholic faith, as you know, but Charles's Catholicism was not yet the Catholicism of the Catholic Reformation. Tolerance went with his faith. He was willing, after all, in this great settlement of the empire, which he tried to bring about, and which you will read in the so-called interim of 1658, he was willing to let the Protestants have communion in both kinds. He was willing to have marriage for priests. His Christianity was not yet the Christianity of the Catholic Reformation, for the great influence on Charles V came from his native region. The great influence upon him was without a doubt Christian humanism, the Christian Renaissance of the Netherlands, the ideal of Erasmus, peace and faith in the Netherlands, where, as you may remember, laymen had taken the initiative to reform the church, the country of what we call, and you read about, as the modern devotion. It is in this tolerant sense, made clear in the interim, that Charles regarded himself as the spiritual arbiter of Europe. This claim to be the spiritual arbiter of Europe, protecting his people as the shepherd, leading them against the infidel who was in the heart of Europe. This claim annoyed the Pope and was to confuse the issue of the Reformation. It was to confuse it very much indeed. But to this claim there was much truth. Remember that the Turk was pressing hard into the heart of Europe, that in Charles V's reign, the Turk stood before Vienna, holy Christian Vienna, in the heart of Europe itself. Later, of course, Lutheranism was added to the Turk as the menace. It was a kind of idea of a crusade. The Muslim world was pressing. And remember also that Muslim world was a prime issue. Not only did the Muslims stand before Vienna, as I told you, in 1524, but they also controlled the Mediterranean. They had just been pushed out of Spain in 1492. They were still a major European power, and a growing one, and as you will see in a minute, an efficient one. Now, how did Charles's view of himself as emperor, his view of empire, how does this translate itself into action? I think it cannot be denied that this idea of God, his piety, his Christian humanism, gave him a kind of indecision at crucial moments, as humanism was apt to, remember, in the Reformation as well. It gave him a kind of fatalism. He was always sort of imbued with the limitations of his actions. He was always averse, very averse, to rash actions, to rash decisions. All in God's good time was his favorite maxim. Now, the result of this approach to his empire and to politics was threefold. First of all, it led to success in the Netherlands, above all. He didn't force the issue in his native Netherlands. Even when unrest became endemic in the Netherlands, even when Lutheranism and then Calvinism made inroads upon the Netherlands, he left the Dutch alone. He never brought himself to take any action against him. His son, of course, Philip II, already a figure of the Catholic Reformation, did act decisively in the Netherlands and brought about the revolt with which we shall be concerned next time. But not Charles, who understood the Christian humanist point of view, who understood the Netherlands as Philip never did. Secondly, you can say in Germany he was unsuccessful because of this indecision. He hesitated too long over Lutheranism. He gave Lutheranism and Lutheran princes too much time to get hold and to grow. And thirdly, above all, with his arch enemy France, with Francis I above all, his outlook made him much too trusting. It's very difficult to explain any other way how, after the Battle of Pavia, when he had won a decisive victory over France, when he was indeed at the height of his reign, at the famous Battle of Pavia, he took Francis I's word and let him go. This is only explained by the kind of humanism, by the fact that he couldn't understand a man like Francis I. For Francis I of France is really the counter-character, the counter-type, the modern type. Francis had no settled religious opinion. To be sure, at the beginning of his reign in France, Francis I allowed a certain amount of reform, and he did it to be nice to his sister, whom he was very fond. But when this reform got out of hand, when what you call posters against the Catholic Mass appeared at court, he clamped down immediately. For the main thing to Francis was to have a church he already controlled, and he controlled the Catholic Church in France. But further, he staged a huge procession to the Church of Saint-Denis outside Paris, a procession of penance for having been so lenient against heresy, for having been so tolerant. But the same time that Francis I went on this famous procession of penance, he was, in effect, almost the same day, making an alliance with Lutheran princes and firming his alliance with the infidel Turk. With Francis I, all that mattered was his power, which was the power of France. And anything went, and religious opinion was totally secondary, as you can see by this example. But Charles, of course, was quite different. He was still a true Christian humanist who believed in the old morality, not of Machiavelli, but that the good go to heaven and that sin is inevitably punished. Francis believed in no such thing. The conflict with France was inevitable, of course. The inheritance of Aragon made it so in Italy. The kingdom of Naples, and you'd better read about that, was the central bone of contention. France claimed Italy, and so did Charles V. Why? Because of a humanist idea, which came, in a sense, from the classical learning and from a kind of parochialism. As Charles's chief advisor, Gattinara, who was his chief advisor during most of his reign, a French humanist, a man steeped in the classic, put it, control over Italy means control over the world. For the precedence was there, had not the Romans, who controlled Italy, controlled the world. Therefore, the fight with France over Italy must be seen not merely as a territorial struggle over the kingdom of Naples, over the control over Milan, but indeed a focal point in the minds of these men for control over the world, for world power, as they indeed saw it. And that you must not forget. Charles himself believed himself to be essentially a man of peace. It's quite Erasmian about him, who by necessity was forced into a warlike role. He advised his son, do everything possible to keep the peace for the sake of Christendom and for the sake of your people. This was part, after all, of the protection of the people. He believed, therefore, in dialogue, and he believed in the Christian humanist spirit that rational discourse will convince heretics. And he encouraged it constantly. You see how false that picture is of the stubborn emperor and Luther. Luther wasn't enamored of rational discourse at all. But the emperor, as an Erasmian from the Netherlands, was very much enamored of discourse, of dialogue, as Erasmus had been. Two examples. When the Lutheran princes had been defeated by him in 1548, he talked to them. They seemed reasonable. Philip of Hesse seemed reasonable. And so Charles immediately dissolved his army because he thought he had them converted. But far from the truth, the Lutheran princes weren't only fighting for Lutheranism. They were fighting for their independence from the emperor. And so you get that remarkable scene that 6 months after his greatest victory over the Lutheran, Charles fled across the Alps, attended by a very few faithful and pursued by the new Lutheran armies. For the Lutherans hadn't dissolved their army, only the emperor had. That is one example in Charles's kind of belief in rational discourse, in peace, in persuasion. The second example is, of course, the Council of Trent, his kind of scheme to have the Protestants appear at the Council of Trent, his belief that then the Protestants would be persuaded, and his disappointment when the Pope didn't play, when the Council of Trent indeed proved rigorous in its first session, even before the Protestants ever appeared. Now, with all of this, what gave Charles his backbone was the Habsburg mission. It is this mission that drove him on. And indeed, you must say at first, overall, that mission was extremely successful, but successful in dynastic terms, not in power political terms, in dynastic terms. After all, it was a marriage which, after all, brought Hungary to the Habsburgs. When the Turks, in a famous battle of the Mohawks, which you will read about, decimated the Hungarian army, killed the Hungarian king, Hungary by default became a Habsburg territory. That was his great success, through marriage, through dynasticism, but not so much through power politics. Moreover, we must not forget in all this the kind of reality that the empire still had. In spite of all that I have said, in spite of his non-understanding, if you like, of the new politics, in spite of understanding of what happened to be the wave of the future, the emperor's jurisdiction was still feared and obeyed. His vice-regents in his territories still had a great deal of power. That, I think, must be said. It cannot be simply said that he had no power. He had a great deal of it. Still, through the prestige of the emperor and through the prestige of the empire, the greatest example here is very simple to relate. It is the example of the Jews. As a typical Erasmian, and with his idea of tolerance, Charles V gave the Jews the most liberal patent, let us patent privileges, we would say, then in existence. These meant that no property could be taken without going through the courts, no ritual murder accusation without going through the courts, and in spite of the temptations that there must have existed to plunder the Jews, by and large, this patent was enforced. So that there you can see that by and large, Charles had more real power still than many are giving him credit for. That too, I think, must be made quite clear and quite obvious. And yet when all is done, of course, Charles failed in the one thing he really wanted, namely to pass his empire on intact. He didn't. Now why? He didn't, first of all, because remember that the emperor was still an elected office, elected by the chief German princes. And the chief German princes did not want to elect somebody as powerful ever again, so that they elected Charles's brother rather than his son. And the empire now went its own way, under what we call the German Habsburgs, becoming ever more feeble and feeble, as you will see, as time went on. The only inheritance, therefore, he could give to his son was Spain, the Netherlands, and the New World, what we now call the Spanish Habsburgs, so that the empire was, in effect, broken up because the German princes, encouraged by France, financed by France, were not going to elect Charles's son emperor. That was clear. And so Philip inherits Spain, the Netherlands, and I must add Italy, at least claims to Italy, which will again later be important. Now, why this failure? What are the basic reasons? First of all, we must not forget, besides his character, besides his outlook and limitations, about which we have talked, that his enemies were well placed to harass him. France in the west, the Turk in the east, the German princes in the center. As a matter of fact, Charles could never concentrate on one enemy at a time. This was due largely to the shrewd diplomacy of Francis I. Whenever Charles fought the German princes, the Turks would act, and then France would act. It was really a three-way alliance against him. France, Germany, and Turkey. And the Pope joined in this alliance. For remember, the Pope had also reason to fear Charles, for Charles had Italian ambitions. The Papal States were endangered. If Charles owned northern Italy, if he made good his claims to Naples, the Pope was wedged in between the emperor. And it's typical for Charles that when in 1527 his troops mutinied and stormed Rome and Clement VII fled to the Fort Sant'Angelo and Charles had the Pope at his mercy, he refused to do anything about it. He refused to do anything about it or to exploit this fortuitous event. As a result, the Pope joined with his enemies, of course, because the preservation of the papal states were involved. And forever now, we will find Pope against Emperor fudging or making very difficult any concerted Catholic actions against the Protestants. The Pope did his best to get the Council of Trent away from Charles V, did his best to defeat Charles V's ambitions, quite clearly. Moreover, Charles faced a national monarch on the one hand, Francis I, but on the other he faced something equally important, namely the Turks, a state centralized, ruled centrally, bound by common institutions, a state, an empire geared for war. Now, I have no time to tell you, you will read about it, I hope, how the Turkish Empire was run. But it was run by slaves only responsible to the emperor. These slaves were only liable to the Sultan, that is to say, to the head of that empire. They were only responsible to the Sultan. And these slaves were both the civil administration of the empire and the shock troops, the famous Janissaries. Who were these slaves? These slaves were originally Christians. The occupied Balkan peoples vied to sell their sons into slavery, because on slaves they rose to high positions in the empire. They were mostly Balkans, they were mostly Christians, these slaves. And as long as this system worked, and it worked in the time of Charles V, it was highly successful. For what did it depend on? The Sultan, the great Sultan of the time, Suleiman the Magnificent, was indeed a man of singular ability. Charles V defeated him once at the famous Battle of Lepanto, which was taken as a sign of Christian victory. But he never really defeated him. His admiral of the Mediterranean kept control of the whole African coast and the coast of Greece. Indeed, you must remember that the Mediterranean Ocean was a Turkish sea, pushed into Vienna. But the Turkish Empire had feet of straw. It collapsed because it was too centralized. Once the sultans declined, the whole empire declined. And that depended on the succession. Because so much depended on the sultan, the practice was to murder every one of his sons except one who would be the heir. That was to avoid civil conflict and civil strife among the sons. Now it depends whether they chose rightly. The story briefly is that Suleiman the Magnificent had a Christian wife, and it was her son whom they chose, and the son, the others from his other many wives, they murdered. So that Selim, whom history has called Selim the Sot, became sultan, an imbecile under whom the whole system went to pieces. How? He gave high offices to Turks, no longer to slaves. The result was corruption set in. The shock troops were no longer slaves, but now almost feudal armies. The result was that rapidly corruption set in. And the whole Turkish Empire begins to decline because the son of Selim and so on down were not people of any ability as well. But Suleiman the Magnificent was. If you ever in your life come to Jerusalem, which is possible, it is a town entirely built these days by Suleiman the Magnificent. Both the famous Mohammedan Dome of the Rock, which he rebuilt, the walls, this whole town is the living monument to Suleiman the Magnificent. And he was indeed perhaps the greatest of Francis I, Charles V, and Suleiman of that triangle that dominated the politics of Europe. Now, the Turkish Empire at first, however, as I said, was of the greatest success. Thirdly, The dynastic idea did not give enough cohesion to his lands. Charles was the only unifying factor. The Catholic faith was, in a sense, the only unifying factor. Spain soon began to dominate for reasons that I told you last time, the Spanish soldiers and the Spanish advisors. Here in itself is a kind of confession of defeat, if you like, when Spain begins to dominate completely in something that was a great European-wide empire. In 1556, it was clear to Charles himself that he could not preserve his heritage. That year, he decided to abdicate and to retire to his beloved Spain. The unique ceremony of abdication took place, however, in his native country, in the Netherlands. The Netherlands, which had dominated his thought, Dutch, of which he spoke in practice. Erasmus, who was in a sense his hero. Charles's speech, which you will read in your European Review, is full of sadness. 9 times he had led expeditions to Germany, 4 times against France, 2 times against England, 2 times against the Turk. Now his health was ruined, but more than his health was ruined. His whole empire, in a sense, lay in shreds. But as he said, typically enough, it was in God's hand to give and to take back, even now, as you will read. He thanks God for his frequent aid. The bitterest pill came last. While he left, as I said, Spain and the Netherlands and Italy to his beloved son, the princes had elected his brother emperor. The heritage could not be preserved. The Habsburg mission had failed. Why Charles actually abdicated, we just do not know. It is quite possible that he suffered from severe depressions. It is quite possible also that he really realized the hopelessness of the situation. It is quite possible that he was really sick with the malady everybody had in that century, the gout, and that by that time, he could hardly move. He abdicated, and of course, there has been a lot of romantic poetry written about it. The great emperor at the monastery door. In reality, it looked quite different. He abdicated to a very luxurious retreat in a Spanish monastery and advised his son left and right. It isn't quite an abdication. He still, as we say, kept his hand in as long as he lived. And as Philip was an obedient son, at least at first, and listened, Charles's abdication is really not quite as singular as it might seem. Now, what when were the long-range results of Charles's failure? About this you must be aware. I am really very sorry that I do not have a map here, because this room doesn't lend itself to a map, so I have to speak in a way in a vacuum. In a vacuum. First of all, this is the climax of the dynastic age. It goes on, it will be changed, as you will see, but it is the last time that you have an empire in Europe based on anything else than force. The next person who tried to unite Europe in this way is Napoleon. So you will never get it again on anything else but force. Power politics, as everywhere, are triumphant. Secondly, it is, of course, the triumph of the territorial state. Even within the empire, in the final religious settlement of 1555, the Peace of Augsburg, which you must know about, every prince determined the religion of his territory. Cuius regio, eius religio. Whoever rules, his religion will prevail. Only Lutheranism and Calvinism were affected. Only Lutheranism and Catholicism were affected. Calvinism, this becomes important later on, was not a part of the Peace of Augsburg. Therefore, the territorial princes and cities in Germany had already won their victory. They were now, in effect, independent states, and the emperor became something ever more shadowy over them. Francis I, of course, won. Won the integrity of France and new territories. No hesitation to ally himself with the Turk or with the Lutheran. Modern power politics won over the Erasmian tolerance and indecision. I can't be very encouraging to you on that subject. Thirdly, in his failure, Charles also in the long run dragged down Spain as eventual consequence. He dragged down Spain because Philip II was a figure of the Catholic Reformation. Because, as you will say, Philip II was not afraid to draw lines. And the lines he drew led eventually to disaster. You know, it's not always good to draw lines. I know how many of you love to draw lines, to make stands, to be counted, or what is the modern term, to reveal yourself. But in politics, as Philip II and others shows, this can be quite fatal. And in a sense, Charles V's policy under certain conditions, as in the Netherlands, to string along could be much more successful. Spain, therefore, was in a way dragged down. Fourthly, these failures meant that the future would belong not to Spain, but to France. That we enter now into the beginning of the age of French predominance and we end the age of Spanish predominance. Roughly the 16th century will be the age of Spanish predominance. The 17th and 18th centuries will undoubtedly be the ages of French predominance. But this was not immediately in the making. The shift took time. And what did it need? Not only the failure of Charles V, it needed also, as you will see next time, the failures of Philip II, the false economic policy in Spain. And it needed, above all, the French religious wars. It needed, above all, the French religious wars. For from those religious wars, France emerged strengthened still further as a nation, strengthened still further as a nation state. But once we reach the age of French predominance, the failure of Charles V had another consequence which you must remember in this regard. It turned France's ambitions to weak and divided Germany. It turned away France's ambitions from the north, from Belgium and the Netherlands, towards which France, in a sense, had looked for her ambition. And it turned her now to a weak and divided empire because the threat that she had faced came from the emperor, came from a strong empire. And so France turned to the empire. It turned and it desired territory now to weaken the empire further, above all, those disputed territories which now first become important, Alsace and Lorraine. You can say that with Charles's failure begins the 300-year war. 300, I can't count. But the war that goes on till 1945, anyway. The war between France and Germany. France turns now to the divided empire for her security after the experience of Charles V, to her security, but also in the end, of course, for conquest and for aggrandizement. That also must be clear. Finally, you must understand and understand quite clearly that Charles seems of another generation than his son than Francis I. We have, in a sense, seen up to now a kind of dialectic at work. For always, and I must emphasize this to you for your studies will make no sense at all unless you have a method by which you look at this whole problem. For always, the new and the old exist simultaneously. For always, they exist simultaneously. As, let us say, Charles V and Francis I existed simultaneously, or the Northern feudal structure and Machiavelli, or the idea of Christianity as the punishment for sinful politics and Machiavelli's idea that necessity conquers Dame Fortune. These ideas existed simultaneously. Luther was a contemporary of Machiavelli, simultaneously. And the new only emerges in a struggle. In this case, or in the case with which we have been concerned, the struggle of the new power politics of Francis I against Charles V, still imbued with an older and medieval Christian morality. And here again, you must integrate something else that you have said, that I have said. To be sure, Francis I believed himself to be a Christian, and perhaps in his soul a good one, though this is doubtful. Nevertheless, remember what was happening to Christianity at the same time, that the power politics was being assimilated. That from that point too, in a way, Charles V seems like a man of an older generation, that for many now, Christianity should be the end, but not the means. That for many, as I told you before, the end must be the reign of Christ, but the means can be the means of Machiavelli. So that in this dialectic between Charles V and his enemies, you see the gradual decline of Christian morality as far as it is applied to politics, as indeed Charles still tried to apply it sincerely and suffered failure in consequence. And you see the emergence from it of a modern power politics, still nominally Christian, but Christianity pushed to the heavens. A modern example will suffice. As the late President Eisenhower always had Christianity on his lips, which you will not remember, one reporter asked him, "How can you be a Christian and build the atomic bomb?" A very sensible question from this point of view. And his answer was, "You must have your head in the sky and your feet in the ground." On the ground. In the ground. In other words, your feet on the ground. In other words, Christianity as a political slogan rather than Christianity as a meaningful moral limitation on actual actions. This is a very important part of the secularization of men and politics, which has been kind of an undertone of almost everything we have discussed. A secularization which I think you see excellently in this kind of dialectic. Now, the religious question, of course, still played a major role. It allied itself everywhere with political problems. It made, from the point of view of the rulers, the political problems intractable. The religious question, whether Catholic or Protestant, provided a platform for opposition to the monarchy, for maintenance of hereditary rights and privileges against the monarchy. The religious question led to the institution of what I have called before revolutionary political parties. Revolutionary political parties against authority, against the monarchy. Thus, from 1555 on, a date you must remember, the date of the Peace of Augsburg the date of Calvin's triumph of Geneva. From 1555 on to roughly 1600, we enter the age of what we call the age of religious wars, an age when many of the European nations, the Netherlands, Scotland, France, were torn by civil war, but civil war of a peculiar kind, a civil war directly related to the issues that I have told you about. Directly related to what? First of all, to the religious issues. This was Calvinism against Catholicism on that level. Secondly, to the political issues. A revolutionary party, which wasn't only interested in Calvinism or Catholicism, which was interested in fighting against the monarchy, either for more power or, if you like, for keeping the hereditary principles, but against the monarchy, Catholic or Protestant. These religious wars are a vital stage in the evolution of things. Why are they a vital stage in the evolution of things? For out of these religious wars, out of these struggles between the revolutionary parties and the monarchy, comes full-blown, finally, the modern nation-state, modern theories of authority, and modern theories of resistance to authority. Both modern theories of authority, modern theories of resistance to authority, as well as in the back door, the idea of toleration. So that in the next weeks we must be concerned with this phenomena, and we shall begin with the revolt of the Netherlands next time.